and then he'll throw a 93-mile-an-hour fastball down the pipe, and Miguel Sano will hit it 450 feet.
I think you're going to see Desmond Jennings traded for opening day, and that's helped provide.
Baltimore's
0-9. 0-9, yeah.
Hey, there's two ties in there, guys, because baseball ties are a real thing. And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars Episode 2, your Orange League podcast. Because who likes grapefruit? Tonight, I am joined by both Joshua Howsam. Hello, Josh.
Hello.
And the incredible Chris Sherwin. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Greg.
So I don't get an adjective? Thanks.
Not this week. I have to look up adjectives in the thesaurus for you because I've used all the regular ones. Didn't have time. Sorry. This week, we're going to talk about the return of Joey Batts and the delayed return of Marco Estrada. We have some... an update on Connor Green, some nice words about Aaron Sanchez. Today, as we are recording, this is actually a very dark anniversary in recent Blue Jays history. We'll get into that. Talk about just the basic spring training update, because who doesn't want to know how many times we've won spring training games? RJ Anderson drops by to talk about the Rays. We have our usual raft of listener questions, and Goose Gossage lost his mind again, and we're going to talk about him because that was pretty entertaining, actually. So let's rewind all the way back to the top. Jose Bautista back in a game. Josh, you're in Florida. Tell me, are you excited about Joey Batts being back in games, or is it not even quite exciting at this point?
Well, I mean, when you're down here, you always want to see the stars play, so it's exciting on that level. But you know, that's the only part of the being in Florida aspect. But just in general, it's nice to know that he's in there, that, you know, that's like, hey, we get to watch this guy play and see how healthy he is and everything. Not that he was hurt, but, you know, still, it's always happy to see guys on the field. So there's no, it's not a lie if we know the truth stuff and a guy's been injured the whole time.
That line will never die.
How can it die? It's the greatest quote in sports history. Because it's the definition of a lie is when you say something that you know is not the truth.
Oh yeah, we got him on that technicality, but he never really fessed up to that. Now, also, we've heard through the usual third party John Heyman tweet that Joey Batts is willing to negotiate.
It didn't seem like he was
really left any gray area when he made the initial statement when they asked him on day one. Did they? Like, did you hear any gray, Chris?
I heard no gray. I'm pretty sure I heard the words, there's no negotiation.
Like, that might have been a direct quote.
I believe it was.
So except for the part...
Yeah, it's like, you know, I don't want to talk about a few dollars here, dollars there. It's like, you know, I have my number and I don't want to negotiate.
So what is it with Heyman's tweet? Is he just making stuff up so he has something to say, or is there actually some sort of weird background politics that goes on with all this stuff and then gets aired out between reporters?
Well, it's kind of hard to say because Bautista was reached for comment after, and he said, "I'm not talking contract." It's like,
which is,
he specifically said, like, there's nothing has changed essentially. So who knows where Heyman got it from?
But he had to report it because it's an unsubstantiated rumor from a source. Where would we be without those this spring?
According to my dreams.
According to something in my tea leaves, Joey Batts is willing to negotiate. So we don't have much on that. We do have something more definite on Marco Estrada. What's the exact word there?
Well, yeah, more definite. Somewhat more definite. Basically, the hope now is that he's going to get into a game next week and then he'll be ready for spring training, but Gibbons sort of covered that.
Do you mean opening day?
Said that, like, what?
You said he'd be ready for spring training. I think you mean opening day.
Oh. Well, hopefully he's ready for spring training. I don't actually know if that's true yet. But even if he's not, the Jays don't need a fifth starter until I think it's April 16th. So there's no risk, as at least the way Gibbons tells it now, of him going on the DL or missing time. It's just that he might not start in the first couple times through the rotation.
Interesting. So just when Gavin Floyd was getting his hopes up, he got crushed by the schedule, possibly.
Well, I think they'll use five starters if five people are healthy.
But they don't
have to. It's just if Estrada can't go, they'll go Stroman, Dickey Hap, and then whoever is the last starter, and then Stroman again.
Right. Fair enough. Are you still out there, Chris?
I'm here.
Now, I understand you had what we will qualify as breaking news, though by the time people can hear this, it won't exactly be breaking news. Connor Green. No.
I'm waiting for our breaking news sound.
The worst breaking news sound ever. Just us making random noises.
I already forget the breaking news. He was optioned where?
Somewhere.
Oh God.
We bring Chris
Connor Green
on for...
Josh, take it.
Was reassigned to minor league camp. Woo. He has not been optioned anywhere yet. He's not on the 40 man. He can't be optioned.
So they're not letting him hang out with the big boys anymore.
Which is interesting timing because he pitched yesterday. Again, recording this Thursday. And he looked really good. And everyone was talking about how he's turning heads at camp, throwing 98 miles an hour. But that's actually why he was sent to the minor league camp. So that he can't get hurt and then go on the major league DL. They're like, no. Protect this guy. Get him away from the team.
That's an interesting strategy or note on strategy that we don't... I don't think we think about that, that, you know, things like service time accrue when you're on the DL and you don't necessarily want that to happen ever. You don't want the guy to get hurt in the first place, but it's even worse when you're paying him major league money and accumulating major league service time. So goodbye, Connor Green. We'll see you again soon.
No bunting drills with Josh Donaldson.
We're getting there.
Well, he can do them on the minor league camp. He can go get hurt over there.
It's fine. No,
you're
it's
so
not.
Nice on this podcast.
We are not going to wish anything ill of Connor Green because he is the bright light on the horizon. One of a few, I guess. We have some nice words about Aaron Sanchez. Would you like to hear nice words?
Yeah.
It's from his own coach, so I don't suppose that they have to be. I wasn't expecting to hear nasty words. But on Tim and Sid today, Pat Henkin made a guest appearance, and he got asked this question.
The roster has the potential to have Cy Young stuff.
That's a good question. I think that Sanchez probably is the first one that comes to mind. He's got the big power arm. He's got the good movement. His curveball was really good yesterday. So I think that if Sanchez is given the opportunity as a starting pitcher, we'll see how it goes. I don't know what they're going to do, but right now it looks like he's definitely got a really high ceiling. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the guy throws mid to high 90s. He's got movement. I mean, his movement's like Scott Erickson. I know that I'm kind of showing my age here, but...
Yes, Pat, you're showing your age when your comp is Scott Erickson. That's a long time ago. But the first name that sprang to mind as a Cy Young potential was not Marcus Stroman. Do you think that's now, you know, fuel for Stroman, or do you think that's a more realistic... more realistic take, Chris?
Well, he's his best friend, so I don't think it's any kind of fuel. But, I mean, I think if you're talking to me and Josh, you know, you got two guys here who seem to be, like, the only people who still want to see Sanchez as starters. In Jay's land, everyone is just, like, nuts about him being a reliever. And, I mean, hearing this stuff only gets me more excited about Sanchez as a starter.
I saw that game that they were talking about where he had referenced his stuff and his curveball. He looked awesome in his outing against the Twins. He pitched three innings. The first two innings, he was throwing 98, 97, painting low and away, low and in, and actually hitting the corners he was trying to throw to, as opposed to like last year in the bigs. He'd paint the outside corner, but the catcher was set up inside. And, you know, he had the hammer curveball, but he also sort of faded when he got to the third inning. So it would be really interesting to see what happens as his innings build up this spring, because he finally is actually burying his curveball, which he wasn't doing last year. So if he can do that and keep his stuff up, he should absolutely start.
Who was catching for him in that game, Josh?
Martin.
So there's two things there, one of which is, of course, the best shape of his life story that we've heard a couple times, that he specifically aimed to gain weight in order to, in theory, build stamina. The second one is that he's been training at Duke, with Marcus Stroman. And I don't know if you guys read the article on Stroman and his rehab, but part of his rehab and the device that he wears that looks like a sports bra but is not a sports bra, that has all the sensors in it, part of what they did bringing Stroman back was to refine his delivery as he rehabbed. Figure, well, if you've got to go and rehab anyway and build up the muscle strength and everything else, you might as well reconstruct the delivery in a more mechanically sound way. Now, do I believe that they know exactly what a mechanically sound delivery works like, looks like? No, because guys keep blowing out arms despite the fact that we think we know. However, training at the same facility makes me guess that Sanchez was put through at least part of that process, trying to refine the mechanics. And of course, his poor control, I would assume, is a result of poorly repeated mechanics, right? That's usually where the poor control comes from.
Yeah, actually, Keith Law has talked a lot about this, how Sanchez and his short stride and what the Jays did there and how it was going to potentially injure him or his command. His stride actually looked longer 2 days ago. He was really getting down the mound. So maybe that was something that they worked on.
Because they had such good results with Stroman, I think the Blue Jays have kind of given the people at Duke pretty much open rein to do, you know, whatever the pitcher is comfortable with when someone goes out there and works with them. And that leads to that high performance department that we talked about a bit last week that Arden Zwelling had an excellent article on today. I'm big on all these things. We've talked about Stroman, we've talked about Sanchez. Let's go and talk about the dark anniversary that I referred to, which is it has been exactly 1 year, Josh, since
Marcus Stroman was out for the season with a torn knee.
The greatest gut punch in recent memory, I think, for me. Where were you, Chris, when that news came down?
I was at work, and I remember my phone absolutely blowing up. And I mean, like, the last time that it had blown up that much was the night that Donaldson was traded to the Jays. So I just see, like, Stroman, like, you know, subject line, Stroman. And I, like, my gut just, like, fell. I knew immediately. It's like, okay, well, they're either signed him to an extension or he blew out his elbow. So I was somewhat relieved when I found out that it was his knee, because I assumed an arm injury. But still, like, how devastating was that? Beginning of last year, you know, we didn't have a whole lot of... I recall, I think two of us thought that they were going to make the playoffs as the wild card, but I don't know. At the time, I wasn't that high yet, and this was just, it was draining.
And you're...
I was actually down here in Dunedin last year when it happened, and it was crazy. The news started filtering through the stands, and it was just silent and depressed. Like, you know, the game was going, and people were excited, and then nothing. Like, you know, they do their stuff where they hype up the crowd between innings. Nobody was clapping. No, like, because everyone was just, like, so somber. Oh, wow. God. Stroman. No.
Absolutely. What are we going to do? I mean, that was the question. What are we going to do? How do we take the best single piece on the pitching side we thought we had and... it just evaporated right in front of everybody. For all of us, I think that was the gut punch moment. Now, I think that the tweet, "The return shall be legendary," whenever he tweeted that, which was not that day.
I think
day.
It was like a day later.
Yeah, it was right. It was close after, but not the day he actually did the injury. I looked at that and I thought, you're probably right. You're going to eat that up with however you come back, whenever you come back. Now, I kind of imagined it as a reliever in the playoffs if he was serious about that, do the, you know, David Price is a rookie thing. But what he did come back and do was awesome. What people, I think, tend to forget about the bat flip game is who pitched the first six innings of it.
All of the pitching is sort of forgotten about that game. Do you remember who was on the mound when the weird stuff happened?
Aaron Sanchez.
Sanchez.
Well done.
Well, because I thought Sanchez wouldn't have had the presence of mind in a million years to go get the ball, even if Odor hadn't broken for home plate. I just look at Aaron Sanchez and I do not think slick fielding pitcher. I'm sorry, Aaron. I don't mean it personally.
Wow.
I just remember looking at his face on all those replays, going, he's just... wondering what to do, like everybody else. So those are our dark, sad memories. Moving on to spring training 2016, when we don't really have anything catastrophic to report so far, and the Jays are winning baseball games.
8-1.
Woo! Do you remember was it 2013 that it was just a wonderful spring training?
It wasn't. I mean, they started off really slow, and people were like, oh, what's going on? What's going on?
I could swear there was
eventually they got fired, and they ended up leading the league in spring training wins. But at the beginning, people were like, oh, no, all these new players aren't meshing. We've lost 3 out of 5 spring training games.
Yeah, I think they lost like 3 or 4. And then they went on this huge run and finished spring training on a big winning streak. And then Jose Reyes hurt his leg, and the downward spiral began. So I... Ever since then, I used to think spring training was maybe just, you know, fun to watch them win. Now it's like, whatever. I would much rather see individual performances. As in, you know, how many times are they getting on the field? Long silence.
Something nicely.
Anything else going on down in Dunedin that you've noticed, Josh?
A couple of notes on players that I've been watching.
Sure.
I've been sort of trying to see what these new swings look like, specifically with Pilar and Tulowitzki. And Pilar's looks way better. He just looks so much more balanced when he swings, as opposed to sort of being like way out in front and throwing his hands at the ball like he was doing for most of last season. Tulowitzki's swing actually looks kind of the same, but it just has that leg kick, but the timing is there. So I wouldn't read too much into that yet, but at least he's not struggling with it.
He's changed more of the timing mechanism than he has the actual the mechanics of his upper body and lower body working together during the swing, is what you're...
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
On the negative side of things, Storin is rounding into form rather slowly. He's throwing 91, 92. I mean, I have never seen his spring trainings before. This might just be what he does, but he doesn't look quite that sharp yet. And Steve Delabar is bad.
He has options, doesn't he?
No, he's out.
Really?
Yeah. Every now and then, he'll throw like that nasty splitter. And so, oh, yeah, right. And then he'll throw a 93-mile-an-hour fastball down the pipe, and Miguel Sano will hit it 450 feet, which is what actually happened. And you're like, oh, yeah, right. That's the bad part.
Josh, did you see Hutch throw?
I did not.
And did you get to see our friend David Aardsma? He's not really our friend, but, you know, he was very friendly.
Nah, he threw on the road.
I see.
I got to talk to him, though, briefly, and went to see him and say, you know, thank you for joining the podcast. He was happy to do it.
Good to know. And that's going to let me do one of my wonderful segues. How about that? We have someone else who joined the podcast and was happy to do so. RJ Anderson of Baseball Prospectus came to talk about the Tampa Bay Rays and what their season might be like. And we're going to be right back with him just after this.
You nailed that.
Sweet. And we are joined tonight by RJ Anderson of Baseball Prospectus. RJ, welcome to Artificial Turf Wars.
Thanks for having me.
We're pleased to have you on, and we brought you here today to continue our tour of the AL East preview, and we consider you something of an authority and or fan of the Tampa Bay Rays. So we're wondering, we'll get right into it, what would you say is the biggest addition and then maybe the biggest loss for the Rays over the last offseason as the team has changed?
Well, I don't think they had a typical offseason in a way that you can say, okay, they had a big gain. I don't think you can point to one single move. I do think they had two or three trades that you can kind of cluster together on the potential impact scale. I would say, you know, trading for Hank Conger, and that gives them a left-handed hitting, I know he's a switch hitter, but his platoon numbers are bad against lefties. So it gives them essentially a left-handed hitting catcher who can receive. I know he has issues throwing, but their staff is generally slow to the plate anyway. So unless we're talking about an elite or near elite thrower and, you know, obviously pop times and all that, they're not going to have great success throwing out the extra skillers anyway. I would also lump the Brad Miller trade in there. They didn't really have a good option at shortstop entering the offseason with Eschubel Cabrera qualifying for free agency. So Miller gives them another left-handed bat, one who, like with Conger, you might have to platoon him, but he's your most days starter, and he's definitely an upgrade over Nick Franklin and Tim Beckham, who, you know, again, entered the winter as their top choices at shortstop. And last trade, I would say the Corey Dickerson trade, that he gives them a thumper, a left-handed thumper. They haven't had a good left-handed source of power since, geez, I mean, Carlos Pena, Matt Joyce, back when they were hitting for power. So I think you look at those three moves in combination, and I think you can pick, you know, any of the three if you want to say it was the most impactful addition. But I don't think there's necessarily a clear winner there for me. As for the biggest loss, I think that's definitely trading Jake McGee as part of the Dickerson trade. The bullpen, as it is currently constructed, is, you know, basically hopes and dreams. You know, they hope that Danny Farquhar can bounce back, and the Brad Boxberger, which is more like the first half than the second half, and they can dream on Manny Romero, who makes the mechanical adjustments during the season. They can dream on him becoming like a McGee light, be without the control, and they can dream on Alex Colome becoming, you know, the four-pitch, death-dealing reliever that he looked like at times late last season. But, you know, the bullpen, it's going to be a weakness for them unless all those things come to fruition, because they don't have a kind of impact waiting reliever that McGee was. And they also traded Kevin Jepson last deadline, so they're really running low on proven related options in general. And their biggest offseason addition beyond the Frostbar deal was Ryan Webb. So, you know, it's a bullpen that's going to have to prove itself time and again. And even after they've done that a few times, we're still going to have questions about, you know, are these guys really going to hold up for 162 games? And, you know, it's not like they have a great deal of relief prospects on the way. They have some interesting ones, you know, Jamie Schultz, Parker Markel, Dylan Floro, you know, some guys who potentially could step in and be useful relievers. And I guess I should throw Andrew Bilotti in there as well. He saw some big league time last season, but I don't think they have the kind of late inning presence that you would expect from a team that leaned on the bullpen so much last season. So I would definitely identify the E-trade as the big spot.
Well, specifically with that trade, it was kind of interesting. Obviously, on a value perspective, getting Dickerson for a relief pitcher was very, very good. But as you mentioned, yeah, the bullpen is now very thin, and the outfield is quite the opposite. They have at least five or six guys that you could say are regular outfielders, especially, I mean, if you go Souza, Dickerson, Jennings, and Kiermaier, that's four guys that kind of have to start, plus the younger guys like Matu. How are they going to handle that?
I think you're going to see Desmond Jennings traded for opening day. And that's health provided. He's had some knee issues, and he's blamed that on tropical outfield turf. So the way the roster is constructed, they can't really carry Jennings as a DH. That would limit their flexibility too much. And I think if you look at Brandon Guyer, and you mentioned Mikey Matuk, I think those are going to be in some combination there, your reserve outfielder. I don't think Matuk is necessarily guaranteed to open the season on the bench, because for as good as it was last season, you know, Guyer played well as well, and while they didn't prefer Iowa or Grady signed more last season, which is an obvious sign, I think you're going to see them stick with Guyer because the option Book still has one left, and it makes more sense based on the race history to keep both pieces intact than to trade Guyer and Jennings and roll the Took. So I think you're going to see an outfield as Dickerson left, Kiermaier in center, through the junior provided come opening day with Guyer on the bench.
So,
all right.
One of the other, you know, parts of this offense that we're kind of wondering about is Evan Longoria, who has looked to be, frankly, fading over the past few years. What role does he have on this team? Is he still the number 3-4 sort of hitter, or is there what are they planning to do with him? Do you think?
I'm inclined to believe he's still going to be the third or fourth hitter in the lineup. You know, he's been dealing with some wrist issues in the past few seasons. And while you're right that he's looked a little older than you would like to see, given his contract situation, I think he's still an above-average third baseman. defensively and offensively. So he might not be a star or superstar level necessarily, but it's hard to see them, you know, there's really no alternative to him, and they continue to give him, you know, the third or fourth spot in the lineup until he absolutely cannot do it anymore. And, you know, we talk a lot about his declining production. At the same time, he's really upped his durability. You know, it wasn't too many years ago. Those Eric Chavez comparisons were getting a little concerning because he missed a lot of time with injuries. And it looked like he wasn't going to be able to stay on the field for 140, 150 games. But you check his game played call in the last few seasons, and he's just turned it up. You know, he's played basically every game. I think he had his consecutive start streak snapped, I want to say last summer because he was sick or whatever. But, you know, he's really become a durable player. So while the production has slipped a little bit, you know, if you figure in, if you do the calculus and you figure in what it would take, what they would get from replacement players at third base compared to Longoria now, you know, it might not be as big of a drop-off as it seems, but obviously they would like to see him return to his old offensive form, just with his new durability intact.
Well, we'll certainly be watching for that this year to see if he can bounce back to become the star that basically everybody thinks he is.
Right.
But, you know, I imagine the people listening to this right now are like, you're talking about the Rays and you started with the bullpen and the outfield. You know, this is a team that's known for its starting pitching. And right. It looks like it's going to be really good again, too, with Archer and Smiley up top. And then I guess you got Moore and Cobb coming back and Reese. But it also seems like there might be some injury risk there, too, right?
Absolutely. That's that might be the biggest question actually heading into the season is, you know, can Drew Smiley actually make 30 plus starts? Can Alex Cobb come back for, you know, August or September as has been rumored? You know, Archer, he's basically your lockout right now. You know, he's the guy you're absolutely expecting 32 starts from, 200 plus innings and so on and so forth. You know, can Jake Odorizzi continue his evolution? Because, you know, it seems like every season, this was a guy who was like a four pitch, you know, four average pitch guy when they first got him. He's since kind of rebuilt himself where he added that split change to Alex Cobb taught him, and that became an out pitch for him. Last season, he added a cutter. He has a slow curveball in his arsenal, so he's kind of become at least a number three starter for them. Maybe he takes another step forward. You know, it's hard to tell. And you have Matt Moore making his first full season appearance since Tommy John surgery. He looked better late last season, but you know, you can't be certain because even before the injury, his command was a little shaky. So we'll see how that goes. And, you know, you talked about, you know, we didn't even mention Erasmo Ramirez, who was a very pleasant surprise for them last season. I'm not sure that's 100% sustainable on his end. However, they do have some depth coming as well. You know, Blake Snell, Jake Ferrari, or Fiari, however you pronounce that, and so on and so forth. So they have some guys who, you know, they could be up during the season. It's not necessarily going to be Matt Endres or, you know, Chase Whitley if and when he comes back. So they do have some options. And as a whole, you would like to think bullpen's going to be a strength. But, you know, if they do get struck by three, four injuries or two or three injuries like they did last spring, yeah, things might get a little dicey. So I'm leaning towards calling that a strength, but it comes with that asterisk that, yes, things could get tricky if they sustain two or three injuries like they did last spring, again, this spring.
So you mentioned Chris Archer first as a big factor on the field. A lot was made in Toronto this last season about the off-the-field part of a baseball team, and of course, that endless argument of okay, the guys all getting along and the guys all motivating one another is a big deal, but how much of a big deal is it? And it seems like since sort of the roster's turned over there, there's been a lot of attention and some comments on Twitter between Chris Archer and Price and that about specifically about being a leader and about guiding the team. It seems like a big burden to put on Archer, but it's the only name I see coming up over and over again about being the clubhouse leader, the guy who's going to guide this team to that next level. Do you see him being, you know, embracing that role, and where do you see that going?
Well, I think he's tried embracing the role already. Earlier in the spring, the way it was presented to the public was that he scolded two younger pitchers for not showing up earlier than the veterans. So, you know, you already have that defeated. You know, Archer came up under David Price, and Price came up under James Shields, and, you know, Shields was but he basically created the culture and the idea that you need a staff leader, and Shields was that guy. Price took that over after Shields was traded. Now Archer's trying to do his part. I think it's the case for Alex Cobb, who is probably the closest thing to Shields the Rays have had since, and he might be the closest thing to Shields they have going forward. But the problem with Cobb is, of course, he's not going to be around the team while he's rehabbing, and that really complicates things. So I do think Archer is, as you might say, the most qualified and the most likely to take that leader mantle. Whether he's effective or not, you know, I couldn't. He's a very intelligent individual. You know, he's great on the field in terms of giving back to the community, giving back to, he goes, he's a guy who goes on his days off, and this is during the season. He'll go to, you know, a detention center or whatever in a visiting city and talk to the kids there. So this is a very high makeup guy, a very driven guy. You know, he went from basically a throw-in in the Mark DeRosa trade years and years ago to a guy who signed a long-term extension and who got some play nationally because of his announcing last playoffs. So, you know, he's a very bright guy. He's very motivated. That's basically what you want in a leader. So, you know, I think he'll be fine in that role. I really don't know how to judge that, but I think he has all the ingredients to do just fine. Yeah.
You don't often get a Mark DeRosa shout out.
Yeah.
Hey, we get them here in Toronto.
That's right. That's right.
He actually was awesome here, so it's hard to even make jokes about that.
He was the most effective veteran presence guy in the clubhouse we ever had. And not from the clubhouse, actually on the field.
Yeah, he actually hit. He hit cleanup a few times, which was hilarious. But so we've sort of gone over this. We, you know, the team's strengths, weaknesses, which are a little different than in years past, as you've sort of gone over. And yet, Pecota and John Morosi of Fox Sports are predicting the Rays to come first, and by a decent margin. Are you sort of on that bandwagon?
No. No, honestly, I'm not. You know, I don't necessarily understand the reasoning there, because as we talked about earlier, you know, there are some big, big question marks about this roster that, you know, frankly, no one outside the organization or even inside the organization is qualified to say. You know, who knows if Cobb's going to come back late in the season, if at all. You know, who knows how Moore's going to handle a full season. Who knows if Drew Smyly can get through April and May without his shoulder barking. So there are so many questions about this roster. And while I think it's a decent roster, you know, I don't think it has that gear that you can point at and say, yeah, they're absolutely the best team in the division entering this season. You know, I'm more inclined, and I realize that Pecota said has them finishing first as well, but, you know, Pecota and I disagreed on Steven Souza before he was even traded as a Rays. So, you know, I take that into mind, and I say, well, you know, maybe, you know, the Rays are a sabermetrically inclined team. They have guys in that front office who know Pecota. They probably use some of the same tricks in their own forecasting models. So I'm under the belief that, you know, maybe they overrate the same player that Pecota overrates. You know, stuff like that. So for me, you know, I see them, I just don't see them as the division favorite. I think they could win the division, but entering the year, you know, I have them down in the standings, and I think it's just as likely they finish last as them winning the division.
So but before I get more specific on that, I'll back up, because we kind of asked, as we tour the AL East here, we kind of asked the same question at the end of you know, of the segment to all of our authorities on each team, and that is, who is the team to beat in this division if it's not your team, which you don't seem to think it's your team. So
right.
what team are, you know, do you think is the team to beat?
You know, I guess if I had to pick, I would say Boston or Toronto. You know, obviously Boston getting David Price, getting Craig Kimbrell. They really had a nice offseason from a star-studded perspective. And the thing is, I've been burned on them so many times before. You know, the roster always looks so good in March and even early April. And then, you know, it's June and July, and you're looking at it like, what happened here? Why did I pick them to win this division? You know, with Toronto, I mean, that lineup, I mean, good grief. I mean, that's going to be a heck of a lineup. But the rotation, I'm looking at the rotation, like, you know, believe a little bit in this. You know, they don't have that.
Sorry, you're broken up there. Can you start over with "you believe in"? I'll cut it out.
Oh, Wait, which part? For Toronto?
Yeah, for Toronto. Which guys do you believe in the rotation? Because they all got garbled.
Oh, okay. If you kind of believe in Estrada and you kind of believe in Half, you know, okay, maybe they have a couple number threes there, but they don't have that, you know, that knockout ace, that frontline stopper that you like to see on these teams that are in the season. So it's kind of not quite the inverse of Boston star power-wise, at least in the rotation, but, you know, it's enough to make you wonder, is this rotation going to really be able to pitch to Boston and pitch to New York and pitch to Tampa Bay and Baltimore? Because, you know, Baltimore is loading up all these home run hitters too. You know, is it going to be enough to hang in there? And then you look at the bullpen and, you know, some of the same questions are being asked. Obviously, Asuna is good, but what about Storen? Is he going to be able to do it, close it for a whole season and so on and so forth? So I guess I would flip a coin between Boston and Toronto as a team to beat. I don't really have a preference of this two. I can see the pros and cons of both, but I think it's one of those two at this point in spring.
So we're just going to pretend that you said nothing about Boston and you picked the Jays because we're not biased at all.
Well, I was just going to say, don't let Marcus Stroman listen to this podcast because you didn't mention him.
And hater fuel.
He would take that personally. You didn't mention him in the rotation. We were going to ask you also, you said you're really up in the air about Tampa, which is funny because we had Matt Corey on and we asked him about Boston and he gave us like a 25 win range as to what they might do. So how many wins do you think Tampa Bay might come up with when all is said and done?
I'll say 3. I think that kind of is in the middle of the range. You know, maybe
83?
Win. Yeah, I'll say 83.
83 is
good. I think they could. 83 would be, well, y'all would be very good, yeah. Because that means Toronto's all but guaranteed to finish ahead of them. But, yes. You know, it's going to be a tight division. I think it's going to be a tight division race. And, you know, I just don't have the answers to those questions. And I always lean on the conservative side when it comes to injuries. So I can't pick them to win a division or win 90 plus games just yet.
All right. Well, if everyone's predictions, if one team runs away with it, we're all going to have a bunch of stupid looking people on our preseason show. But,
oh, gosh.
So we're probably in the same boat because none of us have predicted more than 90 wins for anybody either. We'd like to thank you for dropping by. Where can people find you on the Twitter?
That would be r_j_Anderson with an O.
And your work is out there at Baseball Prospectus?
Yeah, you can find basically everything I write at Prospectus.
Sounds excellent. Thank you for dropping by, and best of luck to the Tampa Bay Rays up to the point where they are about to pass the Jays, and then not so much.
All right.
Thanks again. Have a good one.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, RJ Anderson. We do appreciate you coming on and talking about Tampa Bay, a team that, I don't know, does the team have any real fans?
RJ Anderson.
At one. He can't buy 30,000 tickets a night, though, unfortunately.
It's just him and Jason Collette, and just they have a lot of freebies.
He seemed confident up to the point where we asked him if he was confident, and then not so much at all.
That's about right.
All right, we got listener questions coming at us left and right. We do appreciate when all of you send these in. So the first one is from Mike at GoSendsGo101, a friend of ours on Twitter. Is Josh's voice or his mic in the best shape of his life or the worst? So my verdict from this end is you no longer sound like you've joined Anonymous and are attempting to conceal your identity from the people on the podcast.
I will be doing the rest of the podcast like this, just so it sounds like episode one.
So, for all of you confused, Josh did have a cold. We didn't think it was going to be that big of a deal, and then we listened back to the audio and got several comments about it. So,
it sounded like I was channeling Darth Vader.
Couple decongestants later, boom, Josh back in the best shape of his life, I think is the answer to that. Okay, for Chris. We got Bird's Eye View saying, what's it like to win games in the Grapefruit League?
Well, I think it's fun. I mean, I know it doesn't matter. Nobody seems to care about win-loss records. you know, as soon as the season starts. But I don't know. I find it fun when my favorite team wins, no matter what time of year it is.
I think Bird's Eye View is especially burnt by that because they don't know.
Baltimore's 0-9.
0-9, yeah.
Hey, there's two ties in there, guys, because baseball ties are a real thing.
You didn't feel like reading the hashtag? Hashtag winless in Sarasota.
We're sorry, guys. We're sure you're going to win a couple games in the regular season. No problem. What do we got next? Somebody want to ask?
I got one here for you.
Okay.
So this is from Brendan Kuhn at BK at Brendan Kuhn. Predictions for average attendance at the Rogers Center for 2016.
I think we're looking in the 38 to 40,000 range. Because you're going to have a lot of sold out weekends, I think. People have talked about, ever since the season tickets went on sale, they've talked about how hard it is to get tickets. So you're going to have those packed weekends, packed giveaways. Middle of the week games, I'm sure you'll still be able to get tickets to, unless this team really takes off. So yeah, I'm thinking 38 to 40, maybe a little higher.
Yeah, I got to go in the 40 range.
Which is insane.
Yeah, I think so too, especially with the way Steven Brooks, who's the VP of business, has been talking. It's like season tickets and flex packs are way up. And then obviously there are going to be a ton of people wanting single game tickets just because of how good the team was. So I think 40,000 might be even the floor.
Yeah, it's hard to say what those midweek games are going to do. Because in Toronto, right, it depends on just how hot people think the ticket is before they go to a game in the middle of the week. Whereas I know the weekend games
are. But I'm just basing this off the people who have already pre-bought tickets, just you know, the number of subscriptions, essentially. So there's that's why I think the floor is around 40,000, just because there's so many people who have to pay for their tickets, who have to go.
Now, our ceiling is 47.5 in the dome as currently configured. They haven't added seats in the offseason, have they?
No, but it's sort of basically the max is 48 with press boxes or with luxury boxes and all that.
But yet 47.2 is sold out some days. That's the weirdest.
Well, it's because sold out just depends on what's happening with the luxury boxes, right?
Mm. Still sounds weird.
Yeah, I know. A variable sellout number.
We're mostly totally sold out. We have another question at Bish_Ryan. Ryan Bishop, what chips do the Jays have left to use at the deadline? What chips will they be willing to move? We'll throw this over to Chris if he has an idea.
Well, I do have some idea. I mean, obviously, it depends on what they're looking for, but I believe you got to think Green and Alfred are probably like the two top like blue chips that they have left.
But are they willing to deal those two chips?
I doubt it very much.
Yeah, I'm with Chris on that. If they're going to be dealing from their prospect depth, you have to imagine it'll be guys like Rowdy Tellez or Richard Urania, you know, those second tier kind of guys, because based on everything we know about Shapiro, he was not happy with how empty the cupboard was when he showed up.
It's like a new government. There's a lot less in here than we thought. That's what happens every time somebody gets elected. Next question will target you, Josh, from Dino at Caruso Comics. If some of the more high-profile non-roster invitees don't make the team, do they go to the minors or try their luck elsewhere?
I'm assuming this question is sort of referring to guys like David Ardsma, Rafael Soriano, Dom Brown. I think those are the three high-profile ones. Of those three, I expect that one of Ardsma or Soriano will make the team. And I think the other one will probably opt out.
No Brad
Brown
Penny
is
on
the
your
interesting
list?
Case. Sorry, what?
No Brad Penny on your list?
Brad, a real high profile. Him and Fausto Carmona. Yeah, but Brown is the interesting one because he was released, right? So I don't know if there's really a job that he sees out there for him. I think he might be willing to stick it out even if he doesn't win the fourth outfielder position.
Interesting. Okay, for Chris from Skeeter at SpezBaby. Sometimes I wonder on the exact origin of people's Twitter names, and sometimes I don't. After what we've seen so far this spring, has anyone's opinion changed about who will be the fourth outfielder? So we did just mention Dom Brown. To review, we also have Ezekiel Carrera, and we just went over this when we were discussing this question, and do you think I can remember everybody's
Daryl
name?
Daryl Siciliani and Junior Lake.
I get Siciliani and Biagini mixed up, and they're a pitcher and an outfielder. That's how much I'm deeply moved by this roster. Any idea, Chris, as to who is in the lead at the moment?
I would assume Carrera, but I got to say, like, if I had my choice, who I'd like to see, I'd like to see Dominic Brown. And that's just more of a personal thing with me, you know, because I still have this, like, pathetic false hope that he could be something. A few years ago, I remember when the Jays were looking for a fourth outfielder who could just, you know, basically be a body. I wanted them to trade for Dom Brown, and I'm not talking about that ridiculous Jose Bautista deal. But, you know, with this team, with the guys who discuss hitting and, you know, Tewksbury, you know, kind of floating around, I have, like, faith that all these, you know, once high-ceiling prospects could be turned around, and I think as just a fan, I'd love to see that happen with Dom and Brown.
I think I definitely agree with that. I think if Brown essentially says, like, if I don't make this team, I'm opting out, I think it has to be him just because of what he can provide. But if he doesn't, I think it's probably going to be a guy like Siciliani or even Lake just because they can play center field.
Which Gibbons has mentioned not having a backup center fielder was awkward at times for them last year. I guess technically you have Michael Saunders.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, so at the game I was at against the Twins, Siciliani hit a monster grand slam against Tyler Duffy. That guy must have nightmares about the Blue Jays. He made his major league debut against them last year and didn't last two innings, giving up home runs to Bautista and Donaldson. And then in his, you know, he makes the spring start against them and gives up five runs in the first.
Did he not get spotted like six runs in that game that he made his major league debut? Like, I'm pretty sure he had a six-run lead, and the Jays came back and just mashed nine runs by the end of the second inning. And it was like, what happened, man? Oh, my goodness. He's the one who spells Duffy with an E, isn't he?
Yeah, D-U-F-F-E-Y.
That's strange. I don't know why I remembered that. Do you have a final question on the list, Josh? We finish
up.
Yeah,
you can answer this one.
Okay.
So this is from Will, who has sent in a few questions at WB222. What is the worst thing that could happen to the Jays this season?
My answer, 2013.
So the worst thing that could happen to the Jays this season is that they go into a time machine.
Exactly. Because it was never a fun time. But Chris might have a more insightful answer than 2013.
Well, obviously, just, you know, everybody gets hurt and, you know, they win 60 games. Pretty much the worst thing that could happen.
And Josh?
But just, okay, if there's, well, I'm going to put this question to you guys. If one player goes down, which one would be the worst for this team?
Donaldson.
Ooh, I got to, yeah, you know what? I was going to say Martin, but I think I got to agree with Donaldson.
Just overall, I don't value. Think it's him. As good as he is. Because this lineup is awesome, even with or without Donaldson. And Matt Dominguez, who would be his replacement, is as good defensively as he is.
So you're going to pick a pitcher?
Yeah, I think it's Stroman.
We already lost. We did that last year.
On the dark anniversary. We missed him again.
We've already relived this, Josh. Don't rehash this again.
I just think it's like he's our one guy who has the potential to provide that top of the rotation stuff. Well, him and Sanchez, but Stroman is more likely. And, you know, if they lose that, it's just a bunch of number three starters, essentially.
Yeah, you're probably as right
as... Yeah, I can see that.
I can't argue the point. Maybe because I'm old and tired, and I don't want to lose anybody.
But my number two would have actually been Martin.
All right. Well, yeah, the backup catching situation, even with Sanchez, is not a backup catching situation. Moving right along, we're going to move to our do-over. This may be the most multi-dimensional do-over that we've ever approached. So I'm going to try and approach it from a safe distance, and I am just going to read some quotes from Goose Gossage, who, after this was sort of right after Bryce Harper said, "I like pimping home runs, and it's okay when a pitcher strikes me out and shows off." in reference to Jose Fernandez specifically, and Goose Gossage came out with, Bautista is an effing disgrace to the game. He's embarrassing to all the Latin players who ever played before him. Throwing his bat and acting like a fool like all those guys in Toronto. Cespedes, same thing. And then when someone realized that they had hit a soft spot, I think they just let him go. So he went on to say, the running game, it's a joke. The game is becoming a freaking joke because of the nerds who are running it. I'll tell you what's happened. These guys played rotisserie baseball at Harvard or wherever the F they went, and they thought they figured the effing game out. They don't know. Expletive deleted. A bunch of effing nerds running the game. You can't slide into second base. You can't take out the effing catcher because Buster Posey was in the wrong position, and they're going to change all the rules. You can't pitch inside anymore. I'd like to knock some of these effers on their ass and see how they would do against pitchers in the old days. Ryan Braun is an effing steroid user. He gets a standing ovation on opening day in Milwaukee. How do you explain that to your kid after throwing people under the bus and lying through his effing teeth? They don't have anyone passing the effing torch to these people. If I had acted like that, you don't go into that effing dugout. There are going to be 20 effing guys waiting for you. Shall I continue? Because he actually goes on.
He's trying to challenge Brian Price's rant for most F-bombs in an interview.
Yeah, he talks about they've been created from the top, from their computers. They are protecting these kids. The first thing a pitcher does when he comes off the mound is ask, how many pitches do I have? If I had asked that effing question, they would have said, son, get your ass out there on that mound. If you get tired, we'll come and get you.
Okay, that's enough.
Well, I am basically done.
Please stop.
That last one, I mean, we'll get to the Bautista stuff in a sec. That's one of my favorite ones. I guarantee you no single pitcher has ever done that.
Well, ask how many pitches they have.
Coach, how many pitches do I have left?
7. Make him count.
He actually doubled down, too. He went on Tim and Sid.
Goose Gossage.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we go Bill Burr?
Of all the shows for him to go on, it's like Tim and Sid was kind of the perfect one.
I just want to go Bill Burr here for a second and be like, if there's anybody that, you know, we expect this to come from, is it not him?
It's definitely him. but then he's talking about how it's affecting people on the Little League World Series. Like, now you see these kids in the Little League World Series act like little turds. Would you let your kids act like that? Hell no, you wouldn't. You
my kick favorite
your kids
part
in the ass
is,
if they acted like that. And he says, look at the debates on TV. What does that have to do with anything?
Chris?
My favorite part of the whole thing was how do I explain to my kid? Well, how do I explain to my kid your rant filled with F-bombs and racism? And like, come on, man.
Oh, and he also said this about pies in the face, the shaving cream pies.
Mm.
If I see another pie in somebody's face, I'm going to break my own TV. Act like a professional.
Well, it's always professional when I break my own TV. I feel professional when I do that.
So I feel really happy for whoever's working on commission at the local electronics store.
I'm going to go right back to the top. Bautista is an effing disgrace to the game. He's embarrassing to all Latin players who ever played before him. Stop. Okay. You cannot have all of this stuff all these different ways. So if the old Latin players played like Latino players apparently play differently, which is with actual human emotions, then those guys would not be embarrassed by Bautista because they played with emotion. So you can't reference old Latin players while you're complaining about Bautista. If those old Latin players played without emotion, and Bautista is playing with emotion, then he's acknowledging that that's the way Latin players should have always played the game. And the guys who played in the past were honoring something that wasn't even a tradition and not being themselves. So either way, you're wrong. I don't care. What?
Yeah.
It's just so ignorant at the level of like you said, racism in there and a whole bunch of other things. And then lastly, when he went into Ryan Braun, this man was, do you know where he was asked these questions?
No.
Yankee camp.
Oh,
he
man,
works
that's amazing.
With the Yankees.
Well, I actually think this question came. He was, yeah, that's right. He was talked about, asked about Chapman.
Yes. So I like that somehow Alex Rodriguez avoided all of his ire, despite the fact that he's the most punished steroid cheat in baseball history. But he goes off on Ryan Braun instead.
Henry Mejia?
Oh, sorry. He lost his crown. I wonder if A-Rod was a little sad that he wasn't the worst steroid cheat in baseball history anymore. I wanted to be the greatest of all time, and now I'm second in something. The do-over. Goose.
Go for Gossage. It, Craig.
We would like you to simply go back in your house and just let the kids play on the lawn. And if ever you are tempted to express your opinion, go out the back door, yell at a cloud, and then go have a nap. And if you do all of that, we will never talk about this ridiculous tirade again. Quality. There's a whole bunch of stupid references in there. All right. Old Man Gossage, thank you for providing us with so much content and everybody else with content today. That's what it was all about, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. He's secretly being paid off by some kind of cabal of journalists.
Goose, we got nothing. Help us out. All right. I'm going to do the housekeeping now because apparently last week I forgot a couple little things. So,
you
the first thing is that Josh has a Twitter too. It is at Joshua Housem, and Chris has a Twitter at CW Sherwin. And just to make it all even, I'm not going to mention my Twitter handle. But we do have
At Coolhead 2010.
Now we're not even. We have a podcast Twitter as well at Turf Pod. What are we doing with that?
Well, we just launched it. So we'll start tweeting out, you know, when the podcasts are coming, asking for questions. So basically, just anything related to the podcast. If you want to find any news about it, that's where you should go.
At Turf Pod. Now, if you follow us on iTunes, is this right? You're going to have to resubscribe.
No, anybody but the iTunes subscribers.
Okay, anybody who follows us any other way through another feed that isn't iTunes, you're going to have to resubscribe. Now, unfortunately, this podcast is not going to show up if you had not subscribed, so you will not be listening to this, except if you're on iTunes. So I have just delivered... What?
This reminds me of last time when Chris, in his do-over, was saying, Anthony Ghost, you should come on our podcast and keep your mouth shut. You know, he was there.
So I have just delivered a very important message to no one who can hear it. But, you know, we'll figure that out later. There'll be some sort of method. All right, now that I got all the housekeeping done, I'm going to ask if either of you gentlemen have a final thought. Chris, first, as always.
I actually have a final thought.
No.
I know this is stunning to everybody. I have a final thought.
Everybody, mark this down in your calendars. This is no longer the dark anniversary.
Best color man in the business has a final thought. And it's a shocking one. To anybody who knows me personally, they will have heard rant after rant after rant about Kevin Pillar, okay? And how he is loved in Toronto and the greatest center fielder in the game and yada, 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 yada. I, Chris Sherwin, am actually feeling pretty good about Kevin Pillar because of the mechanical tweaks that he has been working with. You know, what Josh commented on earlier, I actually have faith in Kevin Pillar being a starting outfielder in professional baseball. These are words that I can't believe I'm saying.
We may actually have to mark this day on the calendar somewhere.
I think we do.
All right, Josh. Do you have a final thought?
I do, just because we can't do a podcast without mentioning Pat Venditti.
Do you happen to have six fingers on your glove?
I actually spoke to him down in spring training. And I asked how it started. And he said that his dad made him start doing it when he was 3 years old. And it's like, we all joke. It's like, if I have a kid, I'm going to tie his right arm behind his back and make him left handed. That's pretty much what happened.
That's amazing and sad.
I mean, it's not like his dad, like, you have to do this. Don't you dare throw that with your right arm. But the way he told it, it's just that he was like, you should try doing this.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah, and it continues to be pretty cool and a wonderful novelty. And now we have pictures of a six-finger glove all over Twitter.
Yeah.
All right, so on that note, this has been Artificial Turf Wars Episode 2. I have been Greg Wisniewski. You have been Joshua Howsam and Chris Sherwin. And our guest was RJ Anderson of Baseball Prospectus. And we will see you next week.
You're both assholes, just so you know.
I was just about to make a comment about no name calling, but apparently not so much.